Welcome to Behind the Sports Medicine Podcast, the podcast that pulls back the curtain on the evolving world of sports science. I'm Andrew Rizza, an athlete trainer with decades of experience in professional, collegiate, and high school sports.
And I'm Cameron Roth, an orthopedic surgeon and a consultant for the Chicago White Sox.
In each episode, we'll explore the real-world challenges and opportunities facing today's human performance professionals.
Our hands-on experience is transforming sports medicine and breaking barriers through innovation and teamwork. We are here at the 2025 NATA convention here in Orlando. It's a pleasure to welcome Dr. John Jardine. He's an emergency medicine physician, medical director of the Falmouth Road Race, and the chief medical officer of the Corey Stringer Institute. Dr. Jardine, welcome to Behind the Sports Medicine Podcast.
Thanks. Great to be here.
How do you plan medical coverage for an endurance event that spans multiple miles and thousands of athletes?
Well, as you said, I'm the medical director of the Falmouth Road Race. That's a 7-mile race, so it's certainly not a marathon. And I have to say that I took over 25 years ago, and I took over from a group that was already doing it, and I kind of stepped into a well-oiled machine. But what we focus on in Falmouth, because it's a race in August, it's hot, it's a 7-mile race, it's a shorter distance, so we think because people run at higher intensity, we see a lot of heat stroke. So what we focus on there is cold water immersion for heat stroke, and we prepare to really take care of any emergency, but certainly we're worried about the heat. So we have, in a 7-mile race, we have 5 on-course tents. We have one at the start, of course, one at the finish, and then along the course. We also have mobile medical people along the course, and they have first aid bags, AEDs, in case somebody drops in the race. Of course, communication is probably the most important thing of any event, of any planning. So we have redundant communications. We have the fire-based radio. We have ham operators, the amateur operators, and of course, cell phones. But I mean, being able to communicate with everybody on the course. And I guess you have to know your event, right? Like I said, we know in August it's going to be hot. We know that people run at high intensity. We're going to see heat illness. So that's sort of our focus. Now, it is summer. We have to worry about asthma. We have to worry about allergies, bee stings, broken bones, musculoskeletal injuries. We have to cover all of that. So we have to be prepared for all that stuff. So we have a group of about 250 volunteers, physicians, nurses, EMTs, athletic trainers, physical therapists, and just a lot of non-medical people too, who help with medical records and setting up and taking down and stuff like that. So it's, you know, again, you have to know your event. If it's a heat-related event, you know you're going to need ice and water. If it's going to be in a cool weather event, you're going to need blankets and things like that. So
today's episode is sponsored by Get Raw, a potent antioxidant blend made with all raw organic ingredients. The Get Raw Ginger Turmeric formulation is 200 to 300 times more bioavailable to the human body. Documented benefits include decreased inflammation, improved digestion, immunity, cognition, and more. Get healthy, get well, get raw, the organic wellness shot. And in your 25 years as medical director for the Falmouth Road Race and as a volunteer for the Boston Marathon, how have you seen the planning for coverage and intervention evolve over those 2.5 decades?
Well, I think the world is heating up, right? So we're seeing there is definitely climate change. I mean, I remember 2023, we broke all records for heat, and then 2024, we surpassed that, right? So here we are in 2025, we don't know, but it seems that the world is getting warmer, right? We're more concerned about heat illness, and, you know, not only is it good to have treatment at the end, but we're starting to think about things about like prevention and how do we make it safer? So do we change the start time of the race? Do we move it to a different time of the year, you know, things like that. I mean, we have to start paying attention to, you know, our climate.
Now, the evolution of treating heat illness has changed tremendously from when I came out of school 30 years ago to now. I mean, our discussions in education was ice in the armpits, general arteries, like groin, behind the neck, monitor temperature. And now the standard in the standard of care has changed tremendously from then to now. I think the position statement with the NATA is cold water immersion, rectal thermometry monitored down to a certain temperature so you can safely transport. Can you explain how that evolution happened and why it happened?
Sure.
And
I think
where we are in kind of going in the future to make sure everybody's doing it.
Yeah. My career started many years ago in EMS, and I learned the same thing, right? Ice in the armpits and around the major arteries. And I think now that we are heading more towards evidence-based medicine, certainly in emergency medicine and all the realms of medicine, you know, we want to see the evidence, right? So there have been actual studies now where we know we can compare cooling rates, ice in the armpits to a fan, to cold water immersion, and we can scientifically say that the best way or the quickest way to cool somebody is with cold water immersion. So when you actually do the studies to show what's superior to other methods, cold water immersion comes out as the gold standard. And yes, part of that is monitoring core body temperature. And there are multiple ways to do that. But again, research shows that the most valid way and the most feasible way that we can do it in the field is with a rectal thermometer. We've done multiple studies. We've done studies even at Falmouth that show when you use something like a tympanic thermometer versus a rectal thermometer, you know, there's absolutely no correlation there, and the best way to measure core temperature is with rectal thermometry.
And where has a lot of the research been done other than Falmouth? Is it through Corey Stringer? And you can maybe explain a little bit more about how Corey Stringer Institute came about.
Sure.
And how that's helping revolutionize how we treat athletes in the future.
Yeah, so the Corey Stringer Institute is named for Corey Stringer. He was a Minnesota Viking. He died in training camp in 2001. It was so hot in Minnesota during that time that the farmers were advised to keep their livestock inside. So the Vikings were practicing. Corey collapsed on the first day and then came back the second day, collapsed again, and unfortunately succumbed to heat stroke. There was a settlement for the NFL. Of course, there was a legal case there where Doug Casa was involved. Doug is now the CEO of the Corey Stringer Institute. Doug was doing heat research at the University of Connecticut. He helped with some of the, you know, I guess some of the legal stuff that was going on with the case. And so when it was all said and done, the NFL said, we'd like to start this institute in memory of Corey so that this will never happen again. So the idea behind the Corey Stringer Institute is to provide the education, the research into heat illness and other conditions too that athletes may face, but certainly heat being the, you know, foremost based on what Corey's story is. And so the research is done there. We have two heat labs at the Corey Stringer Institute. We're building a third, which is almost complete. So we can do a lot of work in the heat lab. We can simulate heat and humidity in the lab. But again, as you mentioned, we have a relationship with, KSI has a relationship with the Falmouth Road Race, where we do lots of research at the race. And in the last 25 years, I guess we've published about 27 different articles, 13 of them in the last 10 years or so. I mean, we're doing a lot of work there at the race to better understand treatment and how do we prevent it.
What does a rapid on-site emergency response to heat-related illness or heat-related collapse during a race actually look like from minute to minute?
Well, I think first of all, you have to be aware of the heat illnesses and sort of be able to recognize that this could be a heat. Again, going back to my time in EMS, you know, it probably wasn't even on the differential. So we train our volunteers to know that, again, in August, most likely this is going to be a heat-related event, right? So if somebody collapses or goes down or is weak in the race, whatever, and we can identify them, there's ways that we can, if they have an altered mental status, we go right to the heat stroke protocol. Otherwise, if they're awake and alert and can participate, we have other ways of cooling people. But I think it's just we do a training for our volunteers so that they know what it looks like and what to expect and how to treat it.
Being a secondary school athletic trainer for almost all of my career, there's been this fear of trying to treat an athlete with heat illness or heat exhaustion appropriately. And that I mean getting them into a cold submersion or ice immersion and then applying or using a rectal thermometer to monitor.
Right.
A couple of years ago, we sat in, there was an event with Corey Stringer out in Springfield. We actually did an event with you guys. And then we invited you in to do some training because we felt it was appropriate to care and have that standard of care at the high school. We wrote it into our policy and we feel it's appropriate. Now, luckily we have not had anything, but we have the pieces in place now. Now that we've gotten a data therm, we have an immersion tub, we have everything ready if something does go sideways. What advice do you have for secondary school athletic trainers or the administrators of those organizations on how we should now move forward and be practicing with that standard of care that the NATA has put forward and the Corey Stringer has put forward?
Well, I think as an athletic trainer, and you can certainly correct me if I'm wrong, it's within your level of training and competencies, right, to perform rectal thermometry. So really, it's something that athletic trainers know how to do. They know how to do it and how to do it correctly. So there really is no reason they shouldn't be doing it. Now, I understand there are lots of misconceptions about rectal thermometry, and I have personally spoken to athletic trainers who say, like, under no circumstances will I ever do that, you know, and there's excuses like it's sexual assault, and it's, unfortunately, there are so many negative connotations about it that people are reluctant to do it. I think, again, it should be standard of practice. It is not invasive. You know, I have lots of stories of people that we've done rectal thermometry on in Falmouth, and we interviewed them afterwards, and like a quarter of them didn't even know that they had their temperature taken.
Yeah.
So, you know, it wasn't an awful process. It wasn't uncomfortable, et cetera. And I think when you're going to save an athlete from exertional heat stroke or save a young kid's life from heat stroke, you can tell the administrators, you know, would you rather explain to a parent why you took a rectal temperature or explain to the parent why their child died, right? So
yes.
I think it comes down to that, right? It's, you know, and it can be done very discreetly. I mean, I think that people think, you know, they're going to be exposed on the 50-yard line. I mean, obviously it can be done very discreetly. It's not a hard process to do. And I think, again, that's the diagnosis, right? There's two things for diagnosis. It's the high body temperature and the altered mental status.
Yeah.
So you need that for diagnosis, and you need it to know when you do start cooling, when do you stop?
Yeah.
During these endurance events, what should athletic trainers and other healthcare professionals look for as early signs of oncoming heat illness?
Well, one of the organ system that's first affected by the heat is the central nervous system. So we know that in particular the cerebellum is particularly sensitive to heat. So the brain is probably going to be the first thing that starts to show effects of the heat. And the cerebellum, if you remember, is mostly responsible for, you know, gait and stability and, you know, things like that. So if you see somebody in the race who's kind of staggering or wobbling or collapses, I mean, certainly those are early signs that, okay, this could be heat illness, certainly. Or a lot of times we talk to folks who they're with their family, they're with their friends, and they say, he's just not making sense, or he's not himself, or he's garbling his words. So any of the central nervous system things will probably be the first things that are going to be picked up by either our volunteers or help or family or friends.
So we talked about cold water immersion.
Yes.
If someone they're out in the field and they're at a cross country race out in the middle of nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
What is the best way for them, or cheapest way, or something that they can have that's quick and easy in their medical kit that they can use to provide some type of treatment to help to at least start the process of rapid cooling
mm-hmm.
for that athlete until EMS arrives to transfer them safely to an ED?
Okay, 2 points on that. I'll answer the first part. A lot of times at events, outdoor events, they may have like a cooler of ice water that, you know, the participants are drinking or using, right? You can start dunking towels in that cold ice water and rotating the towels and rotating them out when they start to get warm. That's a great start to cooling, and it's a great way to start the cooling process. You mentioned calling EMS. EMS is my project right now, if you will. Not a lot of EMS agencies know how to do this or will do this. We did a study where we looked at all 50 states, and we looked at the states that had statewide EMS protocols, and that's about 30 of the states. Of those 30 states that have statewide protocols, only 8 states have protocols that mention cold water immersion or cool first, transport second. So even though you think, okay, we'll call the ambulance, they'll know what to do, that's not always the case. I mean, they may rapidly transport somebody to the hospital, which is not always the best thing to do. You want to start cooling right away.
I think I end up remembering a picture that you showed us from your emergency department in Rhode Island.
Yes.
And the ice machine that might make a cup of ice like every
right,
3 minutes.
Yes.
And you had then panned off to, how do we do this in the ED? And it was a simple $15 body bag that you could use and
exactly
fill
right.
with water, right? So
right.
it's something to provide circumferential coverage to help. And that's something that I had discussed with our fire department in Weston,
mm-hmm.
that, hey, have these on the emergency medical transport devices or the ambulances. And then if you're out in a remote location, we had meetings with them after our trainings with you.
Sure.
And the chief is a former athlete as well. He said, we are not moving anybody until you tell us they are ready to move. So that communication, that relationship is great because
yeah.
of the central town ambulance. Now, what do you do if you have a regional ambulance company that comes in and they're trying to help treat? What's the communication there, since you may get it from a different county or a different town? How do you manage that?
Well, right. You're right that cold water immersion doesn't necessarily have to be in a tub, because EMS is like, yeah, where are we going to put that tub? Where are we going to? We use the TARP method, the TACO method, tarp assisted cooling. So you can use just an impervious tarp, put somebody in a tarp, ice and water, kind of slosh them around. You mentioned the body bag. I tried to call it the impervious shroud assisted cooling because, you know, when you tell a patient that we're putting you in a body bag, you know, it's usually not a good thing. But you're right. It is a waterproof bag that, and we're using it in the ER now. You put the water in there, ice in there, and again, it's a good way to cool somebody. We get good cooling with that. It's important, to, like, we are starting to do this in the ER, so we have a protocol. We have a protocol with the kitchen staff so that we can get large quantities of ice if we need it, even during off hours. So it may be important for people, whether it's EMS or ERs or whatever, like you have to have these relationships beforehand. You can't be figuring it out that day, right? And when I talk to EMS, a lot of the things is, you know, that, yeah, that's great. Where are we getting all this ice, right? So I lectured in Massachusetts when I was in Mass with you guys, and there are more than 3,000 Dunkin' Donuts in Massachusetts. So yeah. Like, you know, if you have these agreements beforehand with, you know, and I don't want to single out Dunkin' Donuts, but Dunkin' Donuts or 7-Eleven or a restaurant or a bar where you can get ice, or you have an ice machine in the station, right? I mean, yeah. This is, again, I think this is something we have to start thinking about. It's getting warmer. There are people out working out in the heat. We're not just talking about athletes. You know, there are people that are working every day in the heat, and eventually they're going to rely on EMS. And, you know, we have to be able to do the right thing.
Today's episode is sponsored by MetOne Technologies. Looking for innovation in orthopedics? Meet the only U.S.-based, Latin-owned manufacturer originally focused on spinal implants, now leading the way in upper and lower extremity solutions. They've just expanded their portfolio with the newly launched Fortis Distal Radius Plating System, 510K cleared and designed for next-level performance. This isn't just progress, it's representation, precision, and results, all in one. How about as an athlete? How should an athlete prepare for a race or an endurance event when they know it's going to be warm? Should they just drink as much water as possible? Should they be drinking whatever brand name hydration solution is out there? Should they be carb loading?
Yeah, we do know that, you know, hypohydration or dehydration is certainly a precursor or a risk factor for heat stroke, right? Because you have to be able to perspire, to evaporate, to cool yourself. So hypohydration, dehydration is a risk factor. So hydration is important. If you're going to be doing an event that you know is going to be warm, acclimatized to that area. I know that sometimes in Falmouth, we have people who come from other states, other countries, and maybe it's not the same temperature there. And you know, you can run into trouble because you're coming into an area where it's a different temperature that you're used to. You're not acclimatized. I know in Boston, you know, same thing. Boston Marathon is in April. April can be 30 degrees. It can be 90 degrees, right? So the people that have been training for Boston have been training in November, December, January, right? It's been cool. So you get a 90 degree day and they're not ready for that, right? So it's all about acclimatization. And of course, as you said, hydration.
How do you manage that athlete that is in visible distress and they are just refusing treatment? And how do you have that discussion, the rational discussion, because they probably are not in their right thinking mind? I mean, short of clubbing them over the head and dealing with the concussion later,
yeah.
How do you deal with that to make sure they get the right medical treatment so they don't end up in some type of other failure that could be really irreversible?
Unfortunately, that is a part of it. One of the mental status changes could be agitation or sometimes being aggressive. Fortunately, it's rather rare, you know, more rare than common, I think. But sometimes it's literally physical muscle. It's overcoming them and getting them into the tub. We know that they're acting that way because they have exertional heat stroke. We know that cooling them is going to make the difference. So sometimes, again, it may be a little bit of physical force. If they can talk, if they're reasonable, I know that we've done in the past, we had a guy who adamantly refused his temperature and he was a big guy who was going to fight us. We convinced him to sit in the tub for a little while. Why don't you just sit in the tub for a little while? And we knew, you know, as he cooled off, he became more and more reasonable and rational, and we were able to then get a temperature, and we knew where we were and when to stop cooling.
And that leads to the next question. Can you still effectively treat that patient or athlete without getting a rectal thermometer and just putting them in the tub? Can you make still the right decision if they refuse that rectal thermometer?
You can. I think cooling is better than not. The rectal thermometry obviously is the ideal way to know if you have somebody who's altered in the heat, likely heat stroke, right? But when do you stop cooling? And that's the important part of having a temperature is when to stop cooling. There have been some folks that suggest that you can kind of watch their mental status, and as their mental status gets better, you know they're better. And we've proven that that's not always the case either. I mean, there is really no direct correlation between temperature and mental status. Just for an example, we had a kid that was 112 degrees rectally, 112 Fahrenheit. We started to cool him down. When he got to 107, he was talking and making sense and perfectly, you know, seemed perfectly normal. 107 is still a critical temperature, right? So if we had taken him out of the cooling, saying, okay, his mental status is better, we would have made a big mistake because he's still at a critical temperature. So again, the importance of rectal temperature when you can to know when to stop cooling.
Are there other methods of cooling outside of the full immersion, whether it's in a tub or a body bag? Are there vests? Are there cooling neck wraps? Are there leg wraps? Are there things that you have to use sometimes in the field?
Yeah, there are other ways to cool people. I mean, let's face it, passive cooling, you know, sitting in the shade is a method of cooling, right? What we like to emphasize, though, is we want a cooling rate that's going to cool them as quickly as possible. And we know that if patients are cooled within 30 minutes, and we have a database of more than 500 people now from even just from Falmouth, if they're cooled within 30 minutes, it's 100% survivable. So when we look at products or methods of cooling, we want to see a cooling rate that would meet that sort of standard, right? So cool as quickly as possible, cool within 30 minutes is ideal.
Now, just for context, for people that don't understand how important it is to cool someone and what the acute or chronic conditions can be from heat stroke or heat exhaustion, we know the ultimate is death, right?
But right.
What are some of the chronic conditions that can occur if you're not treated appropriately?
Well, it's like a multi-organ system failure, right? It's similar to having an overwhelming infection where first the kidneys fail, and it's not necessarily in this order, but you know, the kidneys can fail, the liver can fail, the heart can fail. All of the organ systems are involved. So if you have any comorbidities, you know, if you have some kidney disease or liver disease, certainly you're at risk. But we've seen people who were not treated effectively and or, you know, were not treated at all and but survive, you know, sometimes have lasting effects of a guy who had a liver transplant because he had liver failure. You know, so there are sort of lingering effects, some neurologic stuff that, you know, people have problems with, neurologic problems and or, you know, heat tolerance. People who have had a heat stroke, like, really can't go back to the heat sometimes because it's whatever mechanism got them there in the first place, they're intolerant of heat.
Mm. If you're a healthcare professional or an athletic trainer working your first race or endurance event, what are some tips you can provide to help to prepare them for what to expect?
Well, one of the things we do is monitor the climate. As I said, if you use a wet bulb globe thermometry, and there are, the NATA has charts, the American College of Sports Medicine has charts, you know, there are safe guidelines for wet bulb globe thermometry. So if you pay attention to the weather that day, pay attention to the climate, you can make recommendations based on those measurements, you know, whether you delay the start of the race, whether you provide more water breaks, you know, things like that. So I think being aware of your environment, being aware of the climate, you can make good decisions with that.
Now, how does the team work with predictive analytics and weather forecasting and working with the team to understand what to prepare for? Is that something that's ongoing, like weeks leading up to the races, days? Like, how do you do that and to prepare for what's coming?
Well, we have an understanding that, again, ahead of time, that we know that if we're in the, you know, as an athletic trainer, you know, the black flag, right? If you're in the black, if WBGT measures in the black, then that's a no-go. That's a cancellation, right? So we know that ahead of time. We understand that ahead of time. We're monitoring, like for Falmouth, we'll monitor the weather all week long. We have meetings every day. Because the race is on Cape Cod, there's some unique weather patterns there. We have our own meteorologist on Cape Cod who helps us. So we're watching the weather up to that day. And like I said, if God forbid we're in a 4-day heat wave, chances are we may have to think about canceling the race.
Yeah.
I recently did a half Ironman event in St. George, Utah, where the ambient air temperature was 96 degrees. And at the end of the 5-mile bike climb from mile 45 to 50, up about a 2,000-foot gradient, there was an aid station at the top, and they'd run out of water. How do you prevent that from happening?
Get more water.
Get more water.
Well, I can tell you in my experience at Falmouth, I started, like I said, I was a medical director starting in 2001. 2003, it was like 90 degrees and 100% humidity in the morning. We were supplied with an amount of ice at the tent. We ran out of ice and we had to call in, you know, an emergency truck to bring ice, whatever. But I said, that will never happen again. So from 2003 on, I have a big truck full of ice sitting there that we will never run out of ice.
Now, when you run out of ice, does that mean the ice turns into water or you just
physically ran out of ice. Yeah, we ran out of ice. You know, we said, well, we'll need 500 pounds of ice, whatever. We ran out, clearly ran out. So, you know, again, that'll never happen again. We'll have a truck of ice. So water, I mean, I've heard of other events that have run out of water, and that's just, you know, that's just poor planning, I think. Again, if you're monitoring the weather up until, and you know that it's going to be a hot day, we're going to need water, you have water.
They had plenty of ice, so they would put it down the front and back of your tri-suit,
okay.
But no water.
Yeah, there goes the hypohydration
just
thing.
Right? You just start chewing ice.
Yeah, yeah, I know. Yeah,
right. Then you're going to see your dentist for TMJ. How do you manage triaging multiple heat-related illness at once? Say all of a sudden 50 people come into the tent and you're like, where do we start? Like, how do you manage that? Obviously a great medical team and great communication, but have you ever run into that and how do you manage it?
Well, we have a huge tent. We have a big tent at the finish line in Falmouth and we have at least 30 tubs set up ready to go. Again, over the years in our research, we show that we have about 2 heat strokes per thousand runners. We have 12,000 runners. You do the math, it's roughly 20 a year. Again, some years it's 6, the next year it's 30, right? So we know that we may get about 20 a year. We have 30 tubs set up. As runners come into the tent, they go to the next station. So, you know, section 1, section 2, section 3. We have teams there that are ready. There's physician, nurse, athletic trainer, EMT, whatever. They're ready to receive this patient. And then that's all they have to focus on is the one patient. So they're being triaged at the section. So we just, and again, we have enough sections that we can kind of rapidly get people through.
So I have a follow-up to that on outcome. So predicted outcomes or what you're seeing in the races.
Yeah.
How many, since you started as the medical, or took over as the medical director for Falmouth, how many athletes have come into your tent with heat-related illness or heat exhaustion, heat stroke, that have walked out of your tents and not had to go to the ED? Do you know what that is?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. We send 90% of our people home from the tent.
Now, that's walking out of the tent.
That's walking out of the tent home, going home with family or friend. We would never discharge somebody alone. We discharge somebody with a family member, friend, with discharge instructions so they know what to do, what to watch out for, certainly we monitor them for a long time in the tent to make sure they're ready to go. But we have very experienced people there. We are comfortable with that plan. Again, it's a 7-mile race. We don't have to worry about things like hyponatremia and other things, right? So if somebody recovers from heat stroke and they have somebody that can take them home, we are able to send home 90% of the folks.
And do you know...
Now, I'm sorry. So occasionally people do go to the ER and I usually will leave the race, go to the hospital, check on everybody. Usually people are being discharged by the time I get there. It's just a matter of, you know, maybe they need a little more fluid or some other thing. I mean, we've seen broken bones and things. Obviously that goes to the ER, but yeah, so 90% of our people can go home.
And no casualty rate.
And no, right. We have a 100% survivable.
Zero casualty rate with the treatment of how you're treating now, immersion and retinal
Right, because solution. We have cooling them within 30 minutes to a safe temperature. And right, it's been 100%. And that's with, like I said, it's just about 500 patients.
And that speaks to the treatment. I mean, that's true.
Yeah, right. I think it's right. It's a database that says, yeah, this is going to work. Right.
So
I think,
that's amazing.
Yeah.
What's next for the Corey Stringer Institute?
Well, we're focusing a lot now on the occupational setting because, like I said, we have learned a lot of our lessons from athletics and athletes, but there's people out there that are working in the heat, right? So we're doing work now with Delta Airlines, UPS, people that have to be out there, and they're making modifications to their workday, whether it's more breaks, water breaks. UPS is talking about air conditioning their vehicles, you know what I mean? So they're making adjustments to keep people safe.
What have you learned learned over the decades of working as an emergency medicine physician and also a medical director of the road race in Falmouth that you might be able to pass on to young professionals to make sure they're doing the right thing for their athletes in the future?
Well, I think just to be aware of exertional heat stroke as a diagnosis. Like I said, I remember my early days as in EMS and even in medical school, like probably learned about classic heat stroke, right? The person in a heat wave or the kid locked in a car or something like that, but probably never entered into my differential. When you see somebody who's been active in the heat and they're altered, like that's heat stroke, right? So, and I think that it's starting to catch on. I don't know that we're all the way there, but I think with EMS and emergency medicine stuff, we're paying attention to that and knowing it's going to be a reality, right? It's going to happen.
Yeah. All right. Dr. John Jardine, thank you for your time. Hopefully we'll see you in April at the Boston Marathon, perhaps.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
We appreciate your time and expertise.
Yeah, we'd love to come down to the Corey Stringer Institute. And
come to KSI, come to Falmouth, you know,
yeah,
take a look.
Maybe we can get Doug on camera.
Yeah. Yeah, he's here somewhere.
Tell him to come by and visit. I sent him a message on LinkedIn.
Yeah.
And he probably gets a million of them. But I want to touch base with him so we can come down and visit.
You know, I think in a setting like this, he kind of lays low because everybody wants a piece of him, right?
Yeah. Well, it's a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks for listening to Behind the Sports Medicine Podcast. Follow us on social media, watch full episodes on YouTube, and check out our website.
The information shared on this podcast is for educational and informational purposes only and is not intended as medical advice. Please consult a licensed healthcare provider for guidance related to your specific situation. We'll see you next week.